I think he wants money, Saul whispered. I reached deep under my clothes, fumbled with the bag and withdrew some coins, then offered my palm to the farmer, who scooped them all up with a frown and grunted at us. I had no idea how much I'd given him, nor how much I had left. But he was no longer waving the oar at us, so we were free to go. I helped Saul down onto the riverbank, and then I stepped down myself. As my feet hit Soviet soil, I stopped and drew a deep breath into my lungs. If Tomas were with me, I'd have grabbed him right then, and I'd have kissed him full on the lips. Then I'd have told him all of the thoughts as they raced through my head, how much sweeter the air tasted here, how amazing it was to be alive and to have made it this far, how much closer we were to the life we'd dreamed about. Instead, though, I had Saul, who ambled up to the top of the bank, then glanced back at me questioningly. All I could do was make a note of my thoughts. I promised myself that one day I'd tell Tomas every single thing about that moment. Until then, I had to carry on. Come on, Saul, I murmured as I climbed up the riverbank to stand beside him. We're not there yet, but we're much closer than we were. How many miles? He asked me. I don't even know, I admitted. But I know it's to the east, and it's not far. I offered him my arm. Saul leaned on me just for a moment, then he seemed to lift himself to his full height, and he shook himself.
Enough, he murmured. It is time to carry on.
And after that, he walked all the way to the township. We had to stop a few times so he could rest, but he made it the whole way without much help at all. We had to wait a full day for the train that would take us toward Buzuluk, and there was nowhere for us to go in the meantime, so we slept on the platform. Saul and I crammed ourselves into a tiny alcove near some bathrooms, and we protected the suitcase and our meager food with our bodies while we slept. Despite the hordes of hungry Polish souls around us waiting for the same train, despite the concrete behind us and the cool breeze that never really stopped all night, I actually slept so well that when I woke the next morning, I thought the entire trip had been a dream. I left Saul to find a bathroom, and while I was gone, happened upon a local woman who was selling dried bread to the refugees. I handed over more coins. Again, no concept of how much or how little I'd given her. And when I returned to Saul, I was carrying not one, but two entire loaves hidden beneath my coat. I was worried for a while that I'd purchased too much, and it would go to waste. But in the end, that bread likely saved our lives. The train was a walk in the park for me after the darkness of the truck, despite the fact that Saul and I were sharing a cattle car with several dozen strangers in various states of health and cleanliness. There wasn't even enough room for all of us to sit at the same time. So by silent agreement, we passengers took it in turns, standing on our exhausted feet for hours at a time to free up some space for others to rest. I thought I'd had it tough during the war, but these people had clearly suffered in ways I couldn't even imagine. The woman next to me, sitting all but on top of me, was covered in weeping sores, and I could see the lice crawling through the matted lengths of her hair. Every now and again she'd start sobbing, and then just as abruptly she'd stop and close her eyes and lean limply into me, as if she'd passed out. The man traveling with her was every bit as thin as Saul, but his skin had taken on a luminescent yellow tinge. There were children on the train who were too traumatized to even cry. They'd just sit in silence, and some of them were even traveling alone. There was no toilet, so people were relieving themselves through a hole in the floor of the train, and I realized some of the sick people couldn't wait their turn when a suspiciously rank slurry started to roll around the floor. I had the suitcase with me, and I nursed it most of the time, too afraid to spoil the food by setting it on the floor and having it contaminated with the waste. I was also too scared to open it inside the train in case we were overwhelmed by the hungry crowd. Instead, I'd crack the lid a little, push one hand inside awkwardly, and rummage around inside. By doing this, I sneaked small chunks of bread to Saul when I thought no one was looking. I'd eat myself by pretending to scratch my nose with my cast-wrapped right hand and sliding my left hand and the food beneath it to my mouth. Within a day of leaving the station, Saul and I had seen enough to know that if we dared to sleep at the same time, someone would steal the suitcase. After that, we slept in short shifts, if you could call it sleep, given the almost impossible physical discomfort we were both in. But as god-awful as all of that was, for me, it was still preferable to the cavity of the truck. The cool breezes and light that crept through the cracks on the cattle car walls made all the difference. Those hints of daylight were actually glimpses of something even more precious. I could see freedom through the cracks of the wall of that cattle cart, as ever so slowly it dawned upon me that I was actually out of occupied Poland. Although I was a long way from safe and a long way from settled, I was finally free from the Nazis. As that realization started to solidify, a heaviness lifted from my chest. It was the dawning of something I'd been missing for years by that stage. The expectation that I was going to survive. As that train ambled forward, I became quite sure that everything was going to be just fine. Because if Saul and I could make it that far, then of course Tomas would. If all that we had left in the world was each other at the end of this journey, that was more than enough for me to look forward to. To most of the people trapped within that train carriage full of sickness and death and stench, the moment surely would have been a low point in their lives. But to me, I felt like I'd stumbled upon the very beginning of the future I'd dreamed about. The journey to Buzuluk took 2 full weeks. The train stopped periodically, but there was rarely food available. And when there was, those poor starved creatures we were traveling with would descend on it like animals. Saul and I managed to make the loaves of bread last for the entire journey. Only on the last day did we entirely run out of food. We were lucky. Several people from our cart died, and on those infrequent stops, the train attendants simply dumped their bodies in fields by the side of the tracks. When the attendant walked past and rolled the doors open and announced that we were at Buzuluk, Saul and I turned to one another and shared a delighted, surprised smile, as if to say, "We're alive. Can you believe it?" He'd grown stronger over the journey, rather than weaker, like most of our traveling companions. And as we stepped off the platform at Buzuluk, Saul actually led the way. He was devastated, of course, but becoming strong enough to put one foot in front of the other and move under his own steam. We stopped in Buzuluk and visited some stores before we made the walk to the camp. Our clothes were disgusting, so we replaced them with the cheapest and warmest we could find. All that I kept was my coat, and I told Saul this was because it wasn't too smelly. But the truth was, Mama's ring was still in the hem. We bought still more dried bread and some biscuits. We were hopeful that once we arrived at the camp, we'd be fed real food. But we couldn't be sure, so we wanted to be prepared. "Well," he said quietly as we followed the last stragglers from the crowd on the train toward the army camp, "what do you think is ahead of us next?"
"Hopefully," I said, "a nice bed with a blanket, somewhere to lie down and actually stretch out, and food. Oh, hot food. Imagine that."
We laughed together, optimistic about the camp we expected to be welcomed into. It was only when the crowd's progress began to slow and then stopped altogether that we realized there was a problem. Soon, soldiers began walking along the line, talking to people, and we saw most of the people ahead of us in line turning back to walk toward the station, cursing and shaking their heads.
"What is it?" Saul asked the soldier as he neared us. The camp is full, he said. The Soviets say we only need 30,000 soldiers. We have over 70,000 people already.
There's nothing here for you. You will have to return to where you came from.
But we need to wait at this camp. We are meeting British soldiers here when they bring a shipment of uniforms. We can't go back.
Frankly, the suggestion that anyone return to that train was ludicrous. It was pointing people to their deaths, plain and simple. Aside from the exposure to disease, no one who was lucky enough to have food for the journey would have had enough to survive the return. The soldier shrugged at us and moved to walk on.
No, I said flatly, and I reached out to take hold of the soldier's arm. I mean it. We are meeting the British here. We will not go back.
Alina, Saul said very quietly, and he touched my arm to console me.
I have not come this far to be turned away now, I whispered fiercely to Saul, and neither have you.
The soldier looked me up and down, the irritation in his gaze giving way to something I liked even less. The sudden flare of interest in his eyes reminded me of how sick I'd felt standing exposed in the strawberry patch that day, right at the start of the war. This time, though, the soldier leering at me was standing right beside me, and my hand was on his arm. I dropped my hand hastily and stepped back towards Saul a little, as if he could protect me.
I could perhaps be persuaded to make an exception for a lovely girl like you, the soldier said, leaning down until his face was very close to mine, and I could smell coffee on his breath. I battled hard against the urge to show my revulsion or lean away, and I went weak at the knees with relief when he stood to his full height, until he added firmly, but just for you, not your boyfriend.
No, I exclaimed, shaking my head frantically. He has to come with me. He has to.
The line around us had all but dissolved. Even those who were intending to stay and hope for the best had shuffled away from me, scared, no doubt, that the guard was about to shoot me. All that I knew was that my future lay beyond the camp. I had to get inside, and I had promised Tomas, so I had to take Saul with me. I started to beg.
He's a doctor. I'm sure you could use doctors in the camp if it's full, especially if the people inside are as sick as everyone here seems to be.
We have doctors, he said. Then he tilted his chin at me. What else do you have, beautiful?
Food?
Try again.
I was getting a pretty clear idea what the soldier might want from me, and it was making me physically ill. My empty stomach threatening to try to empty itself even more. We'd used most of our rubles by then, so all I really had to offer the soldier was some coins, and I'd figured out they weren't actually worth very much. I had to think of something, because I wasn't going anywhere but through those gates.
I have some coins, I offered,
and I rummaged around in my pocket and withdrew what was left.
Please, he scoffed. Don't insult me. That's crumbs.
Gold, I said heavily. I sighed, then said it again. I have gold.
Gold, he said incredulously,
and beside me, I saw Saul raise his eyebrows. I fumbled in the bottom of my coat for the lump, then raised the hem. The soldier continued to stare at me blankly, so I reached for his hand and held it against the lump.
See? It's a ring. Solid gold. If you lend me your pocket knife, I'll give it to you. Surely that's enough to encourage you to let my friend come in with me.
Let me cut it, the soldier said abruptly, and then the next thing I knew, he had taken a knife from his pocket and had sliced the length of the seam.
The ring fell out into my waiting hands, and I was trembling as I offered it to him. The soldier snatched it up into his hand and hid it quickly in his pocket.
Do you have Polish identity papers? No one gets in without them, you know. I can't do anything about that.
We do, I said. Both of us.
Real ones?
Of course, I said, as if he'd offended me. Then I held my breath. But it escaped as a hiccup when he turned to walk away from us. But I started to protest, and he gave me a pointed look and motioned with his head for us to follow him. Saul and I scampered after him, all the way to the gates. The other guards let us in without so much as a second look, and then the soldier pointed toward a ragged tent.
That is where you register. Get your papers ready. And if he's really a doctor, make sure you tell them. They sure could use the help.
After he turned to walk away, the soldier glanced back at me and gave me a wink.
Hope I see you around.
Saul slid his arm around my shoulders and turned me toward the registration tent.
Alina, he said quietly, that was the bravest thing I've ever seen.
Thomas told me to look after you, I said stiffly. But what I was thinking was, one of these days, saving people for Thomas Slasky is going to get me killed.
Where did you get the ring?
My mama, I mumbled. And then it hit me what I'd done, and I had to blink hard to fight back the tears. I had saved it. I was keeping it for my wedding to Thomas. Saul's arm across my shoulders tensed a little.
I'll find a way, Alina. I'll find a way to repay you for this. All of it.
You already saved us. He wouldn't have survived if he hadn't left Warsaw with you. I'm not sure I would have survived if he hadn't come back to me.
I wanted to weep, but we were in the short line waiting to register, and I knew I had to stay calm. I tried to inject some lightness into my tone.
I think we are even now.
Not by a long shot, Alina, but I will find a way.
The line moved forward then, and we shuffled up together. And when we got to the front, with shaking hands, I showed the administrator the falsified paperwork Henry had given me.
Hanna Vishnievsky, he murmured as he scrawled the name down.
But he barely even looked at my paperwork, because his focus was immediately on Saul. He looked closely at Tomas's passport, then peered up at Saul, then back to the aged passport. For a moment, I expected him to comment on Saul's age. He was 5 years older than Tomas, and he looked much older still. But war had aged us all beyond our years. And instead, the guard's gaze narrowed on Saul's hair.
You're not Jewish, are you? He asked.
For a split second, Saul hesitated, so I interjected. Of course he's not. Why do you ask that?
Dark hair, miss. It's a standard question. We enrolled too many Jews in the early days, so we can't let any more in. They aren't really cut out for war. They're just too cowardly.
In an instant, I was speechless with rage. But Saul reached down and he took my hand and he squeezed it. Hard. Then he smiled at the officer as he scooped up the passport quite casually.
Is that all you need from us? He asked with a smile. All done. Welcome.
Where do we go next?
Head over to the next tent. They'll assign you jobs and sleeping quarters.
We walked toward the second tent and I glanced at Saul. I don't know how you can bear it. I whispered shakily beneath my breath.
It's just for a few weeks, he whispered back. We can figure it all out when Thomas gets here. Besides, if they let me work as a doctor, perhaps they will be more concerned with my skill and less with my heritage by the time I tell them the truth.
He exhaled, then he admitted weakly,
Honestly, Alina, I am not yet strong enough to suffer for my faith again. Not yet. God forgive me. But it will be a relief to stay undercover for just a while.
Chapter 36 Alice, Zofia texts me and suggests we meet for an earlier breakfast and try to come up with a plan. So by 8 a.m., we're seated in the hotel restaurant. I order a double espresso because I've had almost no sleep. And for the second day in a row, I order Smollett's. Maybe it's written into my genes because apparently I love the stuff. I kept thinking I had no expectations of this trip, but it turns out I did. I have a day left here to answer Bobcha's unspoken question, but I have no way of finding out how it all fits together. All I really know for sure is that there's an elderly woman named Emilia somewhere here in Poland who regularly visits what might just be an empty grave with my grandfather's name on it. Back home, Bobcha is only getting sicker. It sounds like Eddie is in freefall. Wade is juggling a million balls at once, and some are inevitably falling. Callie is drowning under more responsibility than any 10-year-old should ever have to face. And I'm 5,000 miles away in Poland, achieving nothing for any of them. So, Zofia says lightly, what should we do with this day then? I'd almost forgotten she was there. I grimace as I meet her gaze. I'm sorry, Zofia. I'm going to rearrange my flight and head home today if I can. She tilts her head, staring at me thoughtfully. You're disappointed. I understand that. There just doesn't seem much point in staying. Whatever it was Bobcha wanted me to find out, we seem to be at a dead end, and back home she's getting sicker, so I do a lot of this family history stuff. I know. Sometimes I have customers who travel from all over the world trying to track down their ancestors, and they get here and they can't find anything. The whole country was messed up after the war. Birth records, death records, bodies, stories, all kinds of things were lost and can't ever be found. But there's one thing that can always be found. She raises her gaze to me, then smiles gently. That's the experience of having tried. You've never been here before, Alice. You're probably not coming back, right? Probably not, I admit. My throat is suddenly tight at the thought of the missed opportunities that fly right by me with every second I'm here. Your flight is when? Tomorrow? Yes. You have a hotel room, me, a car, and a full day. Let's use them? But my grandmother and my family. My voice grows husky and I pause to clear my throat. My kids, Eddie is, they aren't coping without me, that's all. Alice, I don't have kids yet, so you go right ahead and ignore me if I'm way off base here, but I just have this feeling that whether you go home today or tomorrow, the outcome is probably the same. You're going to slot right back into your life and carry them all, and a week or two from now, everything will be back the way it was. And when you look back at this amazing trip, all you have to remember are the failures. Okay, we can't figure out what your grandmother wanted you to find. I know that's upsetting and disappointing, but maybe instead, you can just experience a little more of the country that produced her. She slides the napkin off her lap and dumps it on her plate, then stands and shrugs. My two cents, as the saying goes. I'm going to go put gas in my car, and you take some time to think about it? If you decide to stay, I have some ideas how we can kill the time. Or I can take you to the airport if you want. I'll be back soon, and you can let me know what you decide to do. She gives me one last little smile, then leaves the table. I sink back into my chair and look around the hotel dining room. People sit in small groups, eating, laughing, smiling. All of those accents and languages blending together into one generally excited din. Aside from a group of men in the corner in suits, everyone else is wearing casual clothes today. Mostly active clothes, too. I wonder if everyone else here is on holiday. I wonder if I'm the only person in this room who is here, but not really here. It suddenly seems completely, brutally unfair. I'm doing something I dreamed of for years. Yes, this trip hasn't gone as I'd hoped it would. I wanted to go home with answers. Instead, it seems inevitable that I will walk away having only uncovered more questions. I let myself face the full depth of my failure. It seems that I have to accept that Bobcha is going to pass away sooner or later with threads left loose that she hoped I would tie for her. It feels so unfair that after all of the love she's given me, this one thing she's asked of me is something I just can't give her. I want to sulk. I want to run home and spend her last days with her begging her forgiveness. I don't want to give up, but it feels like I have no choice. What else is there left to try? What more would she want me to do? The answer comes in an instant. She'd have me stay. Bobcha would never want me to feel so guilty. She'd never want me to sulk or to throw away this opportunity. I know if she were here advising me right now, she'd give me a haughty look and she'd point to the door. I can hear her voice in my head. Go see some of my country, Alice. You're probably not going to get another chance. She'd have me look around this country she once loved so much and soak it all in. She'd have me take the downtime and resist guilt for doing so. She'd cheer me on and celebrate my courage at having tried. She'd tell me that my family would be okay without me for another day. She'd tell me that my rushing back won't make her better. In fact, it would probably be the only way I could disappoint her. When Zofia returns to the lobby 20 minutes later, I greet her with a smile. Okay, so we have today. What do you suggest we do first? Mountains or salt mines? She says without missing a beat. Which is better? I ask her. Depends. What do you fear more, heights or enclosed spaces? How far underground are we talking? I ask her. 135 meters? I can't quite figure out the math on the fly to convert that to feet, but I know it's a long way, and I hate confined spaces. I shudder and shake my head. No thanks. Mountains it is. 10 minutes later, we're back in the car and headed through the dense traffic and out of the city. Zofia again slips into tour guide mode, pointing out landmarks and historical sites. But this time, I make myself focus on her words, because whenever I let myself zone out, I think about the situation back home and I feel myself tensing up. Fortunately, Zofia is good at this tour guide gig, and by the time we're out of the city and starting the climb into mountain country, my mind is full of information about the region, like she's conducted a rapid-fire brain dump. You must try Ochipec, Zofia exclaims suddenly, and she pulls the car abruptly into the parking lot of a tiny wooden hut by the side of the road. The structure is tiny, about the size of one of the small bedrooms in my house. There's smoke pouring from the chimney, and 5 cars already in the car park. What is Ochipec? She repeats, correctly guessing that I've already forgotten the word. Smoked cheese. Out of this world. Zofia reaches across into her handbag and withdraws her mobile phone, which she switches off. Service is all but non-existent out here, she warns me. Best you turn it off now or your battery will be drained from all of the roaming. Oh, I say, and I hesitate because I ended all of my conversations late last night on a terse note. But my family might need me. We will be back here by about 6 p.m. You can talk with them this afternoon their time, she suggests. I look down at the phone, then sigh and send a group text. I flush with embarrassment when I realize I can send exactly the same thing to Mom, to Wade, and to Callie. I won't have much coverage today. If you need me, I'll be back in range by about 1 p.m. your time. We can talk tonight. I'm really sorry about yesterday, and I love you. And then I follow Zofia into the hut, where I indeed am impressed by the squeaky, smooth taste of smoked Ochipec. The vendor winks at me and insists I also try his homemade lemon liquor, which tastes exactly like lemonade when it first hits my tongue, but scorches the back of my throat like vodka. Zofia and the vendor laugh at the way my eyes widen, and then they laugh harder when I thump my chest as the liquid burns its way down. We are straight back in the car, and Zofia is zooming through the traffic again, stopping only to show me some impressively styled wooden huts and a breathtaking vista from a lookout. And then we keep moving on all the way to the town of Zakopane. It's high in the mountains, so high that despite the summer heat, I can see snow on some of the peaks of the mountains behind it. We stop for lunch, and I pick up some souvenirs from the stores in the town center, necklaces fashioned with Polish amber for Callie and Mom, a sippy cup that says Zakopane for Eddie, some authentic Polish vodka as requested by my dad, and a second bottle for Wade, who surely deserves a drink after what I've put him through this week. When I think we're finished, Zofia steers me back toward her car. The town is cute, sure, she says with a grin, but what I really brought you here to do is the cable car. It's mid-afternoon by the time we reach the cable car station, and I'm taken aback by the insanely long line waiting to ride it. But Zofia asks me to wait at the end, then disappears into the crowd. 10 minutes later, she returns. Good news, she says, motioning for me to follow her. We walk all the way to the front of the line. You get to skip the line. Just one thing you have to promise me. Sure. When you get to the top, go for a walk. Enjoy the view. Take your time. But do not come back down until you've stopped at the restaurant for a glass of wine. It's pretty much the law, she says. Then she winks at me and farewells me to take the journey to the top alone, because she's convinced a Japanese tour guide to let me slip into a spare slot with his group. That's how I find myself standing in a cable car, hundreds of feet above the earth, squeezed into the little space with a dozen Japanese tourists and their guide. It's a two-stage journey to the peak, but 10 minutes after we board, we are almost to the top of an immense mountain. The English announcement in the cable car tells me it is 2,000 meters above sea level.
That's 6,500 feet.
The Japanese tour guide offers me helpfully, and I give him a grateful smile. I leave the group at the cable car and begin the walk up the last little part of the mountain to the summit. There's dozens of people making the journey in each direction past me as I walk, but the tourist traffic ebbs and flows. Just as I reach the very peak, there's a break in the hikers, and for a few magnificent moments, I'm actually totally alone. A sign tells me that the valley on one side is in Slovakia, and the valley below where Zofia awaits is in Poland. The mountains are so high, the valleys below so low, and the shades of vibrant green against the white snow-topped peaks and the milky blue sky is so breathtaking, it actually leaves me feeling a little emotional. I rotate slowly, taking in a 360-degree view of one of the most stunning vistas I've ever seen. 3 days into this trip, it hits me that despite the disappointments, this has been a wonderful experience, and I'm actually lucky to have lived it. Maybe I won't be going home with any distinct answers, but somehow, the chance to connect with the roots of my grandmother's life has been satisfying in a way I'd never anticipated. And having survived this trip, failures and all, has bolstered a confidence I didn't actually know was shaken. Wade has given me a real gift this week, despite the struggle of it back home and my own struggles here. I can't wait to tell him how much of a revelation it has been to do something like this, standing on a mountaintop for no reason other than the sake of the experience. This moment is an investment in myself. I'm giving myself permission to make a memory that benefits no one but me. I love being a mother, and I love being a wife. I even love being a daughter and a granddaughter. But as I stand here on the mountaintop, I'm not any of those things. I am simply Alice, and for one breathtaking moment, I'm completely present. I don't just drink a glass of wine at the restaurant. I linger over it. Then I drink a second, and when I get back down to Zofia, I tell her one glass was for me and one was for her. She laughs, and then she hugs me.
You're finally getting the hang of this travel thing, Alice.
As we pass the cheese huts on the way back into Krakow, I realize that I still haven't turned my phone back on, so I fish it out of my bag and hit the power button. It takes a few minutes to locate the tower, but when it does, a flurry of text messages hits the phone. There are the inevitably chilly, "Thanks for letting us know," messages from my husband, daughter, and mother in response to my warning that I'd be offline. Then a series of completely unexpected texts arrives.
Alice, this is Leah, Amelia's granddaughter. Please call me back on this number as soon as you can. Alice, it's Leah again. I have been trying to call you all day. Please tell me you are still in Poland. Call me urgently.
Hello, Alice. I am very scared I have offended you, and I am really sorry if I did. The policeman was my husband. I just wanted to scare you. I wasn't really going to have you arrested. Please call me back.
Then finally,
Alice, this is Agnieszka Trukin. I am so sorry about the mix-up at the clinic yesterday. I hope it's not too late for you to speak with us. Please call me on this number immediately if you are still in Poland.
Leah and Agnieszka have been trying to call me, I tell Zofia through my shock. Zofia looks at me in surprise, but there's no time to discuss it because I've already lifted the phone to my ear to call Leah back.
Alice, she greets me breathlessly on the first ring.
Leah, yeah, sorry, it's me. I've been out of cell range today.
But you are still in Poland?
Yes, I am. Why, did you... She interrupts me and her words are rushed with urgency.
Can you come to Krakow? Tonight. I can come pick you up if you need transport. I'll come to wherever you are.
I'm on my way there now. My hotel is there. I pause, waiting for an explanation, but when the silence starts to stretch, I prompt her. What's going on, Leah? You said you couldn't help me. Leah draws in a deep breath, and I can hear the remorse in her voice as she mutters,
Well, I still can't, but my grandmother would very much like to meet with you.
Chapter 37 Alina. We'd so hoped that the camp would be, at least, comfortable. But we were sorely disappointed by the reality we encountered. It seemed to me that the whole world had run out of resources in those days because everywhere we went, people were starving and filthy and miserable. The camp at Buzuluk was no different. In fact, it was all the suffering we'd grown somewhat used to, but now intensely concentrated. The entire purpose of the camp was to prepare newly freed Polish citizens to contribute to combat with Allied troops. But there were no weapons to train with, far too few uniforms, and far too little food. Everyone had lice, even Saul and I within a few days, and there was no controlling them, because there was no way to bathe, let alone wash our clothes or hair. The day we arrived, we were told pesticide was on order to treat the lice. When the shipment came on the train a few weeks later, there was a single carton of chemicals provided, enough to treat a few dozen people, as if that would make any difference at all in a camp of nearly 80,000 by that stage. And by then, I was indeed cursing Tomas for the cast, because between the lice and the itch beneath the plaster, I was even itchy in my dreams. Saul was quickly put to work in the medical clinic as Dr. Tomasz Lusky. No one questioned his age or asked to see his qualifications. I was deemed injured because of my ostensibly broken wrist and was assigned to help supervise the orphaned children during the daytime. I protested this at first, having such limited experience with children, but everyone had to do something, and I had no other skills to offer. I'd expected all of those orphaned boys and girls to be miserable and weepy. Instead, they played and laughed and ran, demonstrating a resilience that astounded me. I quickly came to enjoy that work and made friends with the older women in the same role. I was especially fond of Mrs. Conchow, who had been an opera singer before the war, and she'd sing the most beautiful songs with the children when we needed to calm them down for the informal lessons we tried to offer. It was hard but rewarding work. And each afternoon when I finished my shift, I'd feel a sense of intense satisfaction that I was doing something worthwhile for the camp. I couldn't wait for Tomas to arrive so I could introduce him to the children. I couldn't wait to see the pride in his eyes when he saw the contribution I was making. Saul was in his element within the clinic, having quickly taken command of what passed for a surgical ward in the infirmary. But his work was so much more taxing than mine. I tried to keep a close eye on him, checking in with him every day without fail, even though sometimes that meant I'd have to wait hours for him to finish with his patients. The nurses got used to me sitting in their makeshift office, and soon, when I arrived, I'd chat with them and even help where I could with paperwork. I so admired the way Saul carried himself in that place. And I could easily picture Tomas filling a similar role once we landed somewhere and he finished his training. With virtually no supplies and endless patients to care for, Saul was always patient and unfailingly gentle. The compassion and empathy he had for his patients astounded me. When he told me about his day, he'd describe his work as if his patients had done him the favor in letting him treat them. And perhaps they had, because despite the difficult conditions, Saul certainly seemed to thrive in knowing he was useful again. "You wait, Hannah," he'd tell me. He was constantly reminding me of my new name, because I was constantly forgetting to answer to it. "Once your Tomas gets here, I'm going to take him under my wing again, and by the time the British come for you, he'll know more than most professors." We settled into our roles as the weeks passed, but we still met over dinner or breakfast every day. The itch beneath the cast was maddening by then, but Saul had made me promise not to scratch beneath it with a twig as I was tempted to do. Instead, he found a ruler in the administration block, and for a few wonderful minutes a day, he'd slide it carefully beneath the plaster, and with utmost care, he'd rub the skin for me. "We have to be so careful not to disturb the film canister," he murmured to me one day, as he intently concentrated on the task.
And we also have to be doubly sure not to break your skin. Because if you get an infection in there, we will have to take the cast off. Don't try to do this yourself. Promise me.
Okay, I said, lost in the sheer relief of the ruler against my skin.
Good,
he said, and he laughed at the blissed-out expression on my face.
Same time tomorrow?
Sometimes, when we were alone, he talked about Eva and Tikva, about the tender months he had with his daughter, about the happy years he shared with his wife before the war. Other days, we'd talk about my parents or my brothers, or it would be my turn to share a happy story about Tomas. I thought the sharing would help the longing I felt, but somehow it made it worse.
Tomas should be here any day, I'd whisper when the emotions swelled and tears threatened.
Any day now.
Saul would smile confidently, and I'd feel bolstered, reminded of the plan, reassured that everything was still on track and things were going to be okay. But the periods of sadness came and went anyway, especially as it gradually dawned on me that unless Tomas had news of my parents' welfare when he arrived, I had to assume, and then convince myself, that they were dead. When the grief took hold, it was Saul I talked to, and Saul who offered words of comfort. He became a dear friend to me, and I could completely understand why Tomas thought so highly of him.
Hang in there, my friend, he said to me one day when we'd been in the camp for some weeks. Any day now, Tomas will arrive, and then the British will come, and you'll begin the life your parents likely dreamed of for you. A very wise young woman once said that I had to believe I was meant to survive. And now that I'm here, and I am helping these people, I can see that she was right.
We shared a sad smile, and then he added,
It will be the same for you and Tomas.
You seem happy here.
As happy as I'm ever likely to be in what is left of my life. Wherever the camp goes, I'll join them.
Saul shrugged.
I have heard we will be evacuated to Persia soon, because the camp is not prepared for the winter. But whether it's there or here or even the moon, I think maybe my place is helping these people.
Despite the fact that the Polish army wouldn't have even allowed you to join this camp if they knew you were Jewish, I said, a little incredulous at Saul's willingness to forgive.
When the time is right, I'll be honest about who I am, my name and my heritage. And you'll see what I knew all along. When a man is a patient on an operating table, and there's only one person in the room with the skills to save his life, that patient will instantly forget that he used to be a bigot.
I laughed weakly, but then I had a sudden thought.
I'll miss you if you do stay on. I wish you would come with me and Tomas instead. Perhaps we would all be able to settle together in England. Wouldn't that life appeal to you instead?
You and Tomas will have a wonderful life together, he assured me. And it's a life you've more than earned. I won't tag along. A fresh start will do you both the world of good.
Saul had become a good friend to me, an ally when I otherwise would have been alone. It made me happy then that he was thinking about his own future again, even if his eye was still on the war. I was just glad that he seemed to have found a light at the end of the tunnel of his grief. Because in those early days when he was all but catatonic at the loss of his wife and child, I'd thought such a thing impossible. It seemed to me that almost everyone was sick in the camp, and I was no exception. We'd been in the camp for almost 2 months, and I'd had a stomach flu on and off for much of that time. Some nights, I'd try to eat whatever scraps were set out before us, and I'd manage only a mouthful or two before the sickness resurged. I actually felt lucky. I was always able to tolerate at least water, and Saul assured me that as long as that was the case, and I could keep my food down at least once a day, I would be okay. I knew that half of the beds in the infirmary at any given time were patients with acute diarrhea, and when they became dehydrated, they usually died. All I could do was eat when I could and wait for it to pass. At breakfast one morning, I looked down at the slightly moldy bread we'd been served and had to push it away before I retched. I felt miserable that day, and I drew in a deep breath and tried to remind myself this was all only temporary. Tomas should be here any day, I said, and I waited for Saul to echo the reassurance he always provided. Instead, though, he said suddenly, Eva and I really didn't intend to fall pregnant with Tikva. I looked up at him in surprise, momentarily distracted from my nausea, and he shrugged. War is not a time when people plan to bring a child into the world, especially not the situation we were in. But we loved each other, and all we had was each other. So it was natural for us to express that. And I really thought we were being careful, but these things happen. Would you like to know how I discovered she was pregnant? How did you realize? I asked him. Saul smiled sadly. We were traveling from Warsaw with Tomas. We'd been on the road for a few weeks, hiding where we could, eating what he could find for us. He was so much better at scavenging than me. One day, he trapped and caught a duck. Can you imagine? We roasted it on the fire, and it was like manna from heaven, Alina. Oh, the taste and the texture, my God. He pressed his knuckles to his mouth like a delighted child, and I laughed. It was a miracle. Tell me, when was the last time you ate roast anything? I laughed weakly. I can't even remember. Exactly. And there we were, hiding in a cave of all places, and your Tomas provides us a feast like that. We were all so excited. But Eva lifted the duck meat to her lips and put it on her tongue, and then she was ill. She said the taste was divine, but the texture turned her stomach, and she couldn't understand why, he said. The joy had faded from his face until his gaze was distant, but then he turned it upon me. Alina, do you understand why I am telling you this story? I gaped at him, and then there was a rushing sound in my ears, and I knew I was going to be sick again. But it was even worse than that this time, because my whole body seemed to turn to jelly, and Saul caught me as I slid from the chair toward the dirt floor of the dining tent. With help from one of the stronger men from the dining hall, Saul carried me outside into the fresh air. He sat beside me and rested his hand on my shoulder. And as soon as we were alone again, he said, I didn't mean to shock you. Forgive me. I hadn't cried in all of that time. Not in the truck. Not on the train. Not even when I sacrificed Mama's ring. Not in the camp. I had become a braver version of myself than I'd ever realized was possible. But this? This was too much. I had not had a period since we left Poland, but my cycle had been unpredictable throughout the whole war, so I hadn't missed it. But Saul was right. Even when we did get food, I'd been far too sensitive as to what I could stomach. And just like Saul and Eva, Tomas and I had thought we'd been careful, but we'd been dizzy with the joy of finally being together, and we'd leaped into our sexual relationship with less care than we probably should have. Mama will be so angry with me, and Father, and the people here will judge me. No, they will not, Saul said, because Tomas will marry you. But everyone will know before then, Saul. And then, for the very first time, I spoke aloud a thought I'd been too terrified to give voice to until that moment.
He should be here by now, shouldn't he? What if he's not even coming?
If he was really here, what would he do?
It took less than a heartbeat for me to answer that question.
He would marry me. He was going to marry me. He promised we'd find the priest the very day we arrived, but...
Then Thomas will marry you. Today.
I stared at him blankly, and Saul's expression softened.
Alina, I will stand in his place just for now, because that is exactly what he would want me to do.
And later that day, that's exactly what he did. There was much excitement about our wedding among the people we knew in the camp. Thomas was building quite a reputation as a surgical miracle worker, and strangers brought us gifts. There was a perfect little wildflower from a woman Saul had treated weeks earlier, a luxurious new blanket from one of the camp administrators, and, best of all, some soap from Mrs. Conchal. All of the staff at the orphanage had banded together to barter for it. We went to the dining hall for our dinner meal, and by some miracle, the cooks had found a fresh sausage. Saul and I shared it, and it was such a gift and a blessing that for a moment or two, I was moved to deep gratitude by the effort and the generosity of our friends. For a few minutes, I forgot how broken everything was, and I let myself feel happy because I felt so loved and so accepted. But then Mrs. Conchal approached us again, a huge grin on her face, her hands clasped before her chest.
We have another surprise for you, for your wedding night.
And with rising dread, I followed her to a tent that had been moved apart from all of the other tents. No small feat, given the entire camp was overflowing with humans desperate for shelter. This was a small tent, fit only for two.
Surprise, Mrs. Conchal said proudly. Thank you, Mrs. Conchal, I said.
My lips were numb. I could not look at Saul. I couldn't even force my eyes to shift in his direction. Mrs. Conchal kissed my cheeks, then Saul's, then she wished us a good night and left us be. I crawled onto the mattress she'd placed on the floor of the tent, rolled onto my side, and burst into tears.
I'm so sorry, Saul said desperately. Forgive me, Alina. This was never my intention. I didn't think they would...
He's not coming, is he? What if I'm all alone with this baby?
Saul sat beside me, and he rested his hand over mine and gave a gentle squeeze.
Here is the thing, Alina, he whispered softly. War breaks us down to nothing more than our most selfish will to survive. But when we rise above that instinct, miracles can still happen. I helped Thomas. Thomas helped me. You helped me. In more ways than you can ever know. And now, at last and in this small way, I am grateful for the opportunity to help you in return. This, my friend, is how we find the best of humanity during times when the worst of humanity may seem to have the upper hand. You are not alone. You won't be, not for a single moment until Thomas arrives. I traveled from Warsaw with Thomas. I have seen firsthand that his drive to be with you is relentless. This time will be no different. And until that moment when Thomas arrives to take his place, no matter when that moment comes, I will care for you and your baby as if you are my own.
Everything changed after that day. Saul and I were moved into a married couple's dorm, and there was no way for us to avoid sharing our bed on an ongoing basis. We'd suffered more awkward intimacies on the journey to that point, but sharing a tiny single bunk with a man who was only a friend was not something I relished. But the cold was coming in, and the summer tents were not nearly enough shelter. So soon enough, Saul and I were relying on each other's body warmth to keep us from freezing. Every single night, he'd wrap me in his arms, and right beside my ear, I'd sense his lips moving as he prayed without making a single sound. Saul kept his promise. He nurtured me, constantly going out of his way to find me foods I could tolerate. And that was no small task in a camp where food was a scarce commodity. He arranged for my work duty to be transferred to the office of the infirmary clinic, where I spent my days in a heated room, sitting down and filing away patient records and chatting with the nursing staff. Some days, when the kitchen served up a meal I could stomach, Saul would insist I eat his share. And if I refused, he would force me to, lifting the food to my lips in exactly the same fashion I had done for him in the crate on the truck. Had Saul not married me, I would have become a pariah. Unmarried mothers bore an intense stigma even during wartime. Had Saul not cared for me, it's possible I'd have starved early in the pregnancy, when it was so difficult to eat and he worked so hard to ensure I did. I'd had the cast on my arm by then for months, so it was filthy and uncomfortable and starting to crumble at the edges. Other doctors in the infirmary had started to suggest it really should come off, and it was Saul who provided excuse after excuse why I needed to wear it just a little longer. Saul was there for me and my baby when Tomas could not be. I knew that no matter what happened after that, I'd be grateful to him forever. Soon, we'd been in the camp for almost 3 months. My rounding belly was almost filling out against my trousers, and the sickness had finally passed. I was in the infirmary filing when I heard someone calling for Saul from outside. Of course, they were calling Tomas, because that's what we called him in the camp, even me, by necessity. Something I'd never felt comfortable with. This voice was urgent and alien. Saul was in the makeshift theater then, so I went out to see what the fuss was. I didn't recognize this soldier's uniform or the language he spoke. All I knew was that at the end of every sentence, he said a butchered version of the most beautiful words I knew. "Tomas Slaski," the man said, and I pointed toward the theater room. But the man pointed toward the administration block of the camp, and then he said, "British? Britiski? Tomas Slaski?" Suddenly I understood. This man was British, and he had Tomas. Clearly the delay in Tomas's arrival was because his plan had changed. He'd met up with the British somewhere else, and was finally back to get me. I squealed, and I started to run to the administration block. I made plans as I ran. I would throw myself at him. I would smother him with kisses. The camp administrators would be confused because they thought I was married to someone else. But I couldn't use restraint. I couldn't. Once I saw Tomas, I would never, ever let him go, not ever again. There were more men in strange uniforms outside the admin block, and I approached one and asked desperately, "Tomas Laski?" He looked at me blankly for a moment. Then his eyes lit up, and he nodded and looked at me expectantly. And we stared at each other, each waiting for something. I quickly became impatient with him and moved on to another soldier, but got much the same results when I said Tomas's name. "Hannah," a deep voice said behind me. But it was Saul, not Tomas, and I turned back to him frantically.
"They have Tomas, Saul."
"Hannah," Saul said again, very gently.
"Have you seen him? He's here some—"
"Alina."
I froze, startled at Saul's loud and unexpected use of my real name. His gaze softened. "These men are British. They are here delivering the uniforms, and they are looking for me. Do you understand?" They have come to collect Tomas, like we planned. I stared at him, trying to process the implications of this. Finally, the terrible, terrible reality of my situation struck me. Tomas should have arrived by then. Tomas had not arrived, and we hadn't made a contingency plan.
I have to stay, I blurted, shaking my head. I can't leave. He must still be coming. He must be on his way.
Saul caught my forearm and he pulled me into the administration block, and then into a room all on our own. He rested his hands on my shoulders, and he stared right into my eyes.
You have to calm down and concentrate, he whispered. You have to think this through very quickly. We've come so far with that film, Alina. That cast has been agonizing for months, and you've endured it for this moment.
Tomas is not here, but I am sure he's still coming. He will not stop when he gets here and finds we're gone. People at this camp will tell him where we went, and he will find you. But I can't. He broke off, suddenly frustrated.
Alina, if you stay here in these conditions, the chances of you and your baby surviving are slim to none, especially if I go with these soldiers. And I feel like I have to. How can I not tell someone about what is happening at home? How can I betray my wife and my baby and my people by wasting this chance to help?
An hour later, I was sitting in the back of a transport with Saul on our way to an airfield where I would board a plane for the very first time. We had no bags to take with us. The suitcase was long gone, and our only possessions in the world were the clothes we were wearing on our backs and the tiny leather shoe that Saul was still carrying absolutely everywhere he went, tucked into the waistband of his undergarments.
Chapter 38. Alice. Emilia Schlosky is now Emilia Gorka. She's retired from a very successful career as an artist, and she lives in a surprisingly luxurious apartment block with a view of Vavil Castle, just a half dozen blocks from my hotel. When I knock on the door to her apartment, my stomach is churning, and the anxiety only worsens when the door opens and Leah is there.
I'm really sorry, she says. I was just trying to protect her.
Let them inside, Leah, another woman chastises from deep within the apartment, and Leah steps aside. I suspected we shared a likeness from the thumbnail photos of her online, but there's no question now that I'm related to Agnieszka Trukin. We share the same green eyes, and her hair is gray, but we have the same hairline, the familiar widow's peak at the center. She approaches me and takes my hands between hers. She's frowning, though, staring at me hard. And there's an awkward moment where she just stares at me and doesn't say anything until she shakes herself and says, It really is a pleasure to meet you. Likewise, I say, and she smiles. And this is my guide, Zofia. The woman nods toward Zofia, but then we fall into a lengthy silence again. Agnieszka is staring at me, but now she looks quite stricken. I'm confronted by our likeness too, but I don't understand this prolonged awkwardness at all.
You must be Agnieszka? I prompt.
Yes, I'm Agnieszka Gorka Trukin. I'm sorry. She laughs softly. I just didn't expect you to look.
She trails off, then glances at me again, her eyes widening all over again, as if she can't believe what she's seeing.
Leah, she scolds. I can't believe you ever doubted her.
I could see she was related, Leah mutters, but I told you I thought she was here looking for money, and then I really didn't want to upset.
She trails off, and they're both staring at me, until I start to feel incredibly self-conscious. I gently pull my hands back and smooth my hair down. Agnieszka clears her throat, then explains,
Forgive us, Alice. Leah just didn't explain that you're so familiar, that's all. Please, come through to the sitting area. Mama is so very anxious to meet you.
Zofia and I follow her through to a large sitting area, lined with bookshelves and furnished with heavy antique furniture. Seated in one of the deep leather chairs is a tiny elderly woman. Her hair is carefully set, she's wearing heavy makeup and a set of ornate jewelry that's almost as big as she is. She gasps when I step into the room, and I smile at her. But I kind of want to gasp, too, because I actually look more like this stranger than I do my own grandmother. I kind of figured I might share some physical features with my distant relatives here in Poland, but in this case, it's so much more than a passing resemblance, and Agnieszka's odd reaction when she saw me is starting to make sense, because I'm staring hard at Emilia like Agnieszka stared at me. Emilia stares right back, shock in her eyes. Those eyes that are so uniquely colored, the same striking green that Eddie and I share. Emilia reaches out her hands to me, and I see that they are shaking. I approach her hastily, and then because she's sitting so low, I have to crouch to let her take my hands. Her skin is soft and wrinkled, just like Babcia's, and she stares up at me in wonder. Then her hands lift until she's cupped my face in hers. Soon she's crying. Two heavy tears roll from her eyes and into the lined skin of her cheeks and onward, down toward her neck. She starts to speak in Polish, rapid-fire words loaded with those sounds that still seem so alien to my ears, and I'm not even sure who she's speaking to or if she's expressing happiness or sadness. Is she okay? I ask Agnieszka, who has taken the seat beside her. Agnieszka's eyes have filled with tears, and she nods.
She is overwhelmed. She's not sure how this is possible. You are obviously my uncle's grandchild, Thomas, Agnieszka murmurs. Mama is saying that you could be her twin when she was younger, but Thomas died in 1942, before he could marry Alina, so we're not really sure how she came to be pregnant by him.
Oh, I say, and I frown and shake my head. I feel so awkward because I can't imagine it's going to be easy for Emilia to hear the news that her brother did not, in fact, die during the war. But it needs to be done. So I draw in a deep breath and say, I'm really sorry, but that's just not right. Thomas, my pa, only died last year. He had a very long, very happy life in America. There's suddenly a flurry of rapid-fire Polish. Agnieszka, Emilia, Leah, and Zofia all taking turns firing speech at one another, while I stare back at Emilia as she cries and strokes my face. As the conversation progresses, they each raise their voices a little, and to my ears it sounds like an argument. They all fall silent abruptly, and Zofia touches my arm and says gently,
Alice, could we video chat your grandmother, do you think? Emilia would like to see her.
Did you explain that she will be able to understand their Polish, but can't speak back to them? I say, pulling gently away from Emilia's hands to glance at her. Zofia nods.
I explain that. Emilia said she'd hop on a plane and go to America now if doctors weren't all idiots, including her daughter. She's not allowed to travel because of her health. Zofia murmurs softly. I flash Emilia a smile, because that sounds exactly like something my grandmother would say. Then I withdraw my mobile phone from my pocket.
Are you going to FaceTime her? Leah asks me, and I nod. She seems desperate to please now, a complete 180-degree turn from yesterday at the clinic.
Then let me get the big MacBook. Her eyesight isn't the best. The bigger screen will help Babcia see.
At first, I think she's talking about my Babcia, but then I realize she's talking about her own. And of course that makes sense, but it's also kind of shocking after a lifetime of being the only person I know who has a grandmother called Babcia instead of Grandma or even Nana.